America may be a land of promise in the eyes of the world, but no one has promised a job. Likewise, no one has promised a job that perfectly matches their skills and training. Our guest this hour earned a Master of Business Administration degree in his native India, then moved to the United States to join his American wife. For reasons we'll get into, he ended up working in an electronics store in a mall. Deepak Singh tells the story in his book, How May I Help You?, subtitled An Immigrant's Journey from MBA to Minimum Wage. Deepak Singh is originally from Lucknow, India. He earned his MBA in India and worked for the BBC there. Since arriving in the United States and ending his electronic sales career, Deepak is now a freelance journalist and radio producer. He's written essays for NPR and The Atlantic and other outlets and is the author of an earlier book, Chasing America, of Lollipops, Nightclubs, and Ferocious Dogs. Deepak Singh, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you very much for having me, Jeffrey.
It's good to have you. Mobility in society is certainly an issue for immigrants here. I mean, how difficult to move up in society in India, though? I want to hear that background first.
Yes, nobody asked me that question anyway. So it's hard. It's if you're educated in India and speak well and gone to good colleges, good degrees, you can land a good job. It's not much of a problem. But if you belong to a lower strata of the society, like if you're not privileged, if you're from a lower caste, or if your parents had been working, you know, menial jobs all their lives and for generations, it's very difficult for a person to break that cycle and get a good job all of a sudden. It won't. Like a person who sells tea on a street side stall, his son becoming a CEO of a Wipro or some computer company is almost impossible. But if you come from a privileged family, if your parents are wealthy, if they have money, if they've sent you good colleges, then it's almost impossible for you to not get a good job. So that's the Indian story.
So the caste system carries no legal force anymore, correct? But it still sounds like it's a great social force.
Yes, it's a big social force. It's not, I mean, nobody can stop you legally from getting a good job, but people, like, you know, it still exists. And people look at you in a different way if you come from a certain caste.
You mentioned that your parents are both high caste, but talk about your dad and his work for education.
Yeah, my dad was the first one in his family to get a master's and an undergraduate degree. He came to the city from a small village. And he got a good job in an electricity department in a government electricity company. And he worked it took a lot for his family to send him to school. And he worked very hard, and he managed to break that cycle in his family. And then it was easier for us, his kids. We have two siblings who all educated, and we have jobs, and we have been doing much better than his siblings did back in 50s and 60s in his village.
And how much did your parents stress the importance of education to you?
Huge. I mean, from the very, like, as soon as we were 3 or 4 years old, we started going to school, and parents, especially my mother, made sure we went to schools which with English medium. They call it English medium, which means like all your subjects are in English, and there's everything you read and write is in English. And basically, the idea is to when you go to that school, that kind of school, you learn to speak English and write English, and that is a one big step up in getting a good job. So that's what they did, and they made sure that we all went to good schools.
Can you get? Do you think you would have been as successful as a strictly Hindi speaker?
No. It's very difficult if you do not understand or speak English or write English. You can still get a good job in a government, but it can be very hard. And it's also English, the English language, because of British rule in India, it carries some kind of a social stigma to not being able to speak English. The people automatically think you're less intelligent or less polished. And I don't know how to explain that, but in American context, but it's like almost things you had thought of as slightly backward.
That's interesting. 70 years after the Raj ended, too, they were still thinking in these terms.
No, they haven't. You know, like in India, they say Englishmen left, but they left English language behind. But this is a more funny way to say it in Hindi. Like it's more cruder and like, you know, it's like, oh, they left, but they left the language behind. You're still holding on to it, trying to act like them, you know. They're gone.
I would love to hear the Hindi version of that someday. You had, you got to the point in the book where you talked about finishing up your bachelor's degree, and I was reminded of the movie The Graduate, where everybody had ideas for you. and yours somewhat differed. What did you want to do after you got your bachelor's degree?
You mean the degree before MBA, right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So I finished my undergrad. It was commerce, you know, it was business, also like undergraduate level. I did that because my father was an accountant. He got the same degree. So nobody suggested to me that I could be doing something different or what could I be interested in other than that. And I was very young. I was 18. And I don't know. I thought maybe, you know, that helped my father get a job. And so all you need a job in life is a job. So I didn't know then what I wanted. But I did that degree and I finished it, and immediately I was told by everyone else, look, you know, you are 21 years old now and you should hurry up and get a graduate degree and get a job. And so I got into MBA. But I really wasn't sure. I liked languages a lot. I spent a lot of time in British Library in my hometown. There was a library and I listened to a lot of English cassettes and watched the videotapes and read lots of books. And I don't know. I was going through a certain phase in my life where I almost wanted to speak like an Englishman. I don't know what was that about. And listening to Beatles and Rolling Stones and just, you know, wasting my time, basically.
But you did tough it out. You got the MBA. So how did you end up in radio?
Yes. So I finished my MBA. And again, I did not want to do the MBA kind of job, you know, wearing suit and tie, sitting in front of a computer, you know. So I started teaching English language to school teachers. I saw an advertisement in a newspaper, and somebody wanted the 100 teachers who came from a Hindi background, and they wanted somebody who could train them so they could, like, you know, speak better English. So I applied for that job, and I got it. And so I did that, and then I taught some medical doctors. So I was doing all this small, like, you know, short-term jobs. And then one day I met a radio producer from British Broadcasting Corporation in a bookstore in my hometown. And he listened to me, and he's like, hey, you know, how do you speak such good English? I said, I don't know. I mean, I do. And he said, like, okay, do you want to make radio? I can help you. I can train you to make radio stories and edit sound and write scripts. And so I said, okay. I mean, I don't have any degree in radio journalism. I'd love BBC World Service.
All right, let's pick up the story on the other side of a break. We'll figure out how you got from the BBC to coming to America and ending up working at a store that sells radios. How May I Help You is the book by Deepak Singh. Back with him in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Deepak Singh, who's written essays for NPR, The Atlantic, and other outlets. He is a freelance journalist, and he's written an earlier book called Chasing America. His latest work is called How May I Help You? An Immigrant's Journey from MBA to Minimum Wage, documenting Deepak's journey from his native India and his MBA degree to working behind the counter at an electronics store in a mall in Virginia. And you can join the conversation on the Exchange as we talk about mobility in America for immigrants and not. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So I still love the story about getting hired by the BBC, essentially because somebody heard you in a bookstore.
Yeah, they heard me talk, and they wanted to give me the job, and I took the job. And there was no looking back. I'm still making radio stories.
Yeah, indeed. So it was about this point in your life, your parents began to look for a wife for you, and this is where Holly comes in, Holly Donahue, who's now Holly Donahue Singh, to shorten the story just a little bit. So how did you meet her?
Again, I met her in the library that I used to spend a lot of time in. It was a British library, and this lady from, this young girl, 22-year-old from rural Pennsylvania, was there reading a book. I asked her, like, what was she doing, and she said she was there on a Fulbright scholarship for the whole year. So we became friends, and I started teaching her Hindi language and drinking many cups of tea, and she started coming to my home, and she learned the language pretty well. She became very fluent in Hindi, and my parents loved that because they don't speak much English and they could talk to her. And we started dating, and then one fine day, you know, we decided, okay, you know, we should get engaged and get married. And I came to America in 2003.
So how much talk had there been about where you'd work in America before you moved over here?
Yeah, good question. Thank you. So my wife tried to discourage me from quitting my BBC job. She said, you know, this is a good job. You should just keep at it and let me finish my graduate degree here, and maybe I can move to India. But I, everybody I talk to in India is like, well, are you crazy? You don't want to go to America? She's living in America. What are you going to do here? You just quit the job. You'll find something good there. You know, America is the land of opportunities. Just forget about India. Just go. So I just didn't listen to her, and I came to America, and I thought, you know, I spoke well, and if I could land a job in BBC in India, I could definitely land a good job in some radio station in America. And I had a degree, education, and everything, and confidence that came. But then soon I woke up to a rude shock.
Well, and the rude shock is that outside of big cities, the broadcasting industry tends to be a little sparse in America, I guess is what you found out.
Yeah, sparse, and also they cater to the, you know, mostly music stations, mm-hmm. not so much talk radio.
Was there anything in Charlottesville, Virginia, where Holly was working on her degree?
I applied to a lot of places, and they interviewed me looking at my previous experience, but they asked me to go on air as part of the interview process. And I spoke, read a piece of news, and they said, like, you know, we have a slight challenge here, a problem with your accent. You're trying to pronounce things like Pakistan as Pakistan, you know. You're trying to see Baghdad as like, you're doing it wrong. You're saying it's Baghdad instead of Baghdad. I said, I'm sorry, you know, but I think I know how to pronounce those. No, it doesn't matter. You need to pronounce it the way we want to listen. So I started writing news for the radio station, but that was all volunteer work. Mm-hmm. And so I was desperate for money. So I just started applying, you know, left, right, and center. Started looking for signs in the windows, you know, like help wanted or hiring, we are hiring. I started filling out all kinds of applications in bookstores and grocery stores and coffee shops and electronics store. And I was interviewed at the electronics store and I got a job.
I'm glad you went to a bookstore because you've had good success with hanging out in bookstores and libraries in your life.
Yeah, but I don't know. I didn't get the job at the bookstore.
Mm-hmm. So talk about just the process of applying for jobs. I mean, it sounds like that alone is very different from what you were used to in India.
Yeah, it is hugely. I mean, in India, I don't know, because I've never worked in a store in India. And the store jobs are very, very, you don't have to have any kind of education. You can speak whatever language or just not have any kind of degree. You can just go and work, and they train you right on the job floor, and you don't have to fill out any form. You just have to know somebody who's the, like, owner of the store. And there are no chain stores in India. They're all individual mom-and-pop stores. So if you know the guy, if you just somebody introduces you to the manager, the owner of the store, and he looks at you, it's like, oh, is he trustworthy? You know, I have to find a few references. You don't steal you can be trusted. You get the job. But in America, it's all retail stores, you know. So you have to go through their hiring process to fill out the forms, and the forms go to the next level, and they do a background check on you, and you have to take urine tests, so make sure you're not a drug addict, and I've it's like lots of hoops, and finally when you're done interviewing, you get the job and make minimum wage.
Deepak Singh's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about his new book, How May I Help You? An Immigrant's Journey from MBA to Minimum Wage, Moving from India to Virginia. Give us a sense of this time in your life. I mean, you're far from home in a strange land. You're in a new marriage, all that.
Mm-hmm. Then or now?
Then.
Oh, yeah. So, yes, 10,000 miles away from home, and never left my home until the day I left India. I mean, parents' home. I always lived with them.
Wow.
Until the age of 29. And when I left not just the home of my parents, city, and my country. I came to America. So it was a big shock, you know, coming to live in a different country, in a different climate, with different people and culture and different work ethics. And also I was staying in a house full of other graduate students took a lot of getting used to. Eating different kinds of foods, you know, bagels and donuts and all kinds of also a lot of Indians who come to America, they usually come through family or they come to school, they go to school. And when they go to school, they have other Indian students who can go to and, like, you know, get acclimatized and oriented. And but I didn't have anyone. I just had my wife, who was American. She didn't even know. If I asked a question like, hey, you know, Holly, I need to get my hair cut, she's like, well, I can take you to the one I'd go to, and that's the ladies.
Uh-huh.
So she did, and she wasn't basically much of a help in terms of what I needed. And it was a huge transition. And certain, like in a month or two after I arrived, I started doubting my decision. I thought maybe I just, you know, made a big mistake. I quit the job. I married the girl from America. I thought she was nice and everything, and she suited well. But in America, my wife started acting differently. I don't know if you've read the book. She sounded different, and she was American, of course. You know, she was wearing different clothes, and I couldn't recognize her mannerisms. Like, oh, this is the same person I hung out with for 2 years. And sitting around, you know, dining table, drinking wine, and talking about all kinds of, you know, censored topics, which was a daily order. And I wasn't sure what I was doing here, and I was jobless. I'd already quit my job in India. I didn't have any money, and nobody was giving me any interviews here. So I was getting depressed until I found the job in the retail store, which was a whole another world I had to get used to.
Oh, absolutely. So what were your thoughts about applying for low-wage jobs and not getting hired?
Yeah, I had this sort of an arrogant attitude when I came. Like, I have an MBA. I'm educated. I can speak well, and I can have good experience with BBC World Service, and I have to apply for these jobs, and even these people are not interviewing me. So when they finally interviewed me and I got the job, I had this attitude like, you know, I don't really want this job. I mean, why? What's the big deal about it? I mean, I can do the job. Just go ahead and hire me already.
You didn't actually say this in the interviews, I'm thinking.
No, I didn't. But I was always thinking. So when I actually, my first day, I realized within the first few days that the job that I didn't want required a lot of skills just to be able to hold that job. I didn't know anything about selling anything to anyone in anywhere in the world. And selling stuff like, you know, radar detectors and shower radios and stuff like that, the things I didn't know existed. Why would one of people listen to shower radio? Why can't you just step out of the shower and then listen to radio?
You come back to that a bunch of times. The idea of hanging a radio in the shower seems really alien to you.
Yeah, I was like, why? I even asked this customer, I mean, just out of curiosity, why do you need this? I want to know. We have radios and we have shower radios, but why? He said, like, well, my wife gets angry when I'm listening to the radio in the living room, so I need to go in the shower and do that. Like, okay, that makes sense.
All right, so that explains the shower radio. We'll talk about the other stuff that that got sold there, too. Deepak Singh is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He immigrated from India to the United States to follow the love of his life, and they were together in Virginia when he got his first job working at an electronics store, somebody who had an MBA from India and had worked for the BBC. There he was, selling radios. How May I Help You is the name of his book, subtitled An Immigrant's Journey from MBA to Minimum Wage. Join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760. Any immigrants out there with similar experiences to share, we'd like to hear from you. Any people who've hired immigrants, perhaps you could join the conversation as well. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So what was the pay at this euphemistically named electronics hut?
I don't remember. It was something like around pretty close to 5.5, because it was minimum wage. And back in 2004, 2003, that's what it was. I think it's much higher now, minimum wage. But also, I could make commission if I sold well. I could make $2-3 more. But it was very hard for me to sell because I couldn't understand a lot of people in Virginia because of their extra syllable in every word. It's no southern drawl.
Oh, like in your things in your head.
Yeah, like we say shrimp. Shrimp. So. That was like two people speaking English cannot understand each other. It was amazing.
Right. Right. Yeah, it happens even with people who are born in the United States. There was a moment here. It's not just getting used to the retail and the sound of people, but just some social things and hangovers from India. You saw an Indian couple in the store and removed your name tag. That's an interesting moment. Why?
Yes, it's like, I don't know, I mean, how to say this, but... suppose if an American goes to, you know, in India for a holy, looking for like some kind of soul searching trip, and he arrives in Varanasi where George Harrison went from Beatles, and he shaves his head, you know, he walks around barefoot around Ganges, and all of a sudden he sees his parents, and he tries to say, oh, what a freak you are, you know. Why are you doing all this? So it's kind of, I don't know, this is not a good analogy, but I felt the same way. Like, you left your job in India, BBC World Service, you came all the way here, and now you're selling electronics in a sales store? What a loser you are, you know? And that's how I thought that Indian couple might be thinking about me. And it was an impulsive thing for me to do, like take my name tag off and put it in my pocket. And I hid back in the back room, but my manager came and said, hey, Deepak, you know, there's an Indian couple. Maybe you can help them. I don't know what they're looking for. So I had to actually come out and help them. And, of course, they didn't ask me any question, but it was in my head that I was thinking that they might be thinking that.
So, but it sounds like you had similar reactions to other people, and they had reactions to you as well. Seeing people that they thought might have been from the same part of the world, you tended to look to find each other in the crowd.
Yeah, here and on the store.
Yes.
There was another moment when a friend of mine, an Indian friend who had become friend in Virginia, and his parents came. And I was working in the store and he came, but he was walking in front of the store, but when I came out to talk to them, he told his parents that I didn't actually work. I was just hanging out. He was trying to cover up for me. You know, he's like trying to cover up my embarrassment, but him covering up my embarrassment was more embarrassing than me admitting that. But anyway, there's a lot of similar moments. That was all in the first few months, but then I got over it quickly. Mm-hmm. I mean, what could I do? And I had to work, and how many times could I hide?
Right, yeah, after a while, you're going to get kicked out of the back room by the manager.
Right, right.
And I know she called you Deepak, so I imagine your name alone sounds like it caused some difficulties for people trying to pronounce your name.
Sometimes they call me Tupac.
Tupac, as in Tupac Shakur?
Yeah, I didn't know what that meant, and one day I found out, and they were mostly joking about it, and I didn't mind, but then they started, like, putting my name on my schedule, like Tupac schedule.
Really? On the schedule you were identified as Tupac?
Yeah, they would put it on, like, in a board in the back room, uh-huh, and say Tupac. And I mean, I didn't want them to forget that my name was actually Deepak, not Tupac. So it bothered me sometimes, but I was mostly okay with that.
So was the suggestion that you needed to speak English differently by the store manager, did you end up adopting some Southernisms, or did you just sort of speak in a more broad kind of American general accent?
I just started speaking slowly and clearly and making sure my T's, like, you know, if I said total, right, and then, like, in British way, you can say totally unacceptable. I said total, and, like, make T's in a total. Oh, yeah, totally. So I picked up from my own colleagues, my manager, Cindy, my Ron, the colleague. So basically it was all about, like, you know, when you listen to something over and over, your ears get tuned to it. So I was able to hear the Virginia accent. Like every time they said, like, male to male connector. You know, it's male to male connector, right? It's not. There's no extra syllable.
Right, male.
The actual male.
I can imagine. It never occurred to me though that the level of intricacy, though, because you know, people asking you for. I'm trying to go from a quarter inch male connector to a half inch female connector, and plus that you throw the accent on top of that. I can just imagine the, you know, your hands going to the sides of your heads, going, "Oh my God, where do I start?"
Yeah, not only that I don't know what he wants, but I want to understand, like, what does the male to female connector look like?
Uh-huh.
Also, a lot of people came to ask me to program their, you know, cell phones and stuff, and it was lots of intricate things that I had to do. And if there was a problem with the language, they didn't have much patience for me.
Sure. Deepak Singh is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is How May I Help You? An Immigrant's Journey from MBA to Minimum Wage. Let me back up a few steps, because it sounds like you were getting a lot of education about the United States, certainly. And I wonder what preconceived notions you had about this country before coming. You mentioned that people in India thought you were nuts for wanting to stay in India and have Holly move there. Mm-hmm. You mentioned you'd lived in your parents' home until you were 29 years old. What did you think America would be like? And then how did what you found compare with that?
I think people still think of America the same way I did 14 years ago. People think, I mean, I thought, I mostly watched American movies like Home Alone, you know, Miami Blues, all the John Travolta, Nicolas Cage, you know, Face Off kind of movies.
Uh-huh.
And all the things you see, like, you know, a red convertible riding on a nice, you know, boulevard in Miami with a blonde, you know, and with long legs, you know, bikini and pizza and stuff. So you think, oh, this is a beautiful place to be here. I wish I was sitting next to that blonde. And everybody's rich, you know, driving Jaguars and Ferraris, and it seemed like a paradise, you know, place out of, I couldn't, I just thought everybody was rich and driving Cadillacs and Audis and BMWs. But when I came to the States, started working with my colleagues, I realized that that was not everybody was doing that, and people were actually struggling to make ends meet, making only minimum wage.
And Charlottesville is a fairly prosperous town. I mean, it's got the University of Virginia in it, so I mean that's going to be a little bit of recession proofing. But even within that area, it sounds like you found a fair amount of economic disparity.
Yeah, Charlottesville is a wealthy town. A lot of people go to retire there, and the students who go to University of Virginia, they're also wealthy kids. So they are they're not the ones who work in stores like I did. Their parents pay. Sometimes they buy the whole condos, you know, and university somewhere, and they live there. They have a lot of money. But the people who are like from surrounding areas, if you drive 10 miles out of Charlottesville, you can be in rural Virginia pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
And the people living in those areas would come to work, and they were the ones who were struggling, they didn't have very good education, and they also thought University of Virginia was something, you know, they couldn't access. They couldn't go to school. It's like a big disconnect between the University of Virginia and some rural parts of Charlottesville.
Okay, much more to talk about with Deepak Singh. His book is How May I Help You? An Immigrant's Journey from MBA to Minimum Wage. We'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange with Deepak and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Deepak Singh, who is a freelance journalist and radio producer. He's heard a fair amount on NPR, also writes essays for The Atlantic and other outlets, and has written a book about his own experience getting an MBA in India, Master of Business Administration, falling in love, getting married to an American, and moving to Charlottesville, Virginia, and taking his skills to work behind the counter at an electronics store. It's the story he tells in the book, How May I Help You? An Immigrant's Journey from MBA to Minimum Wage. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760. Maybe a chance to share an experience you had similar to this. 800-838-3760 or email us at jx@jeffnet.org. So we've talked about the perceptions that you had of America and what the reality was when you got here. I'm curious to know, other than thinking that you spoke too fast and they couldn't understand you, people thought back about you and where you were from.
Yeah, a lot of people in the store, not everybody, but people who worked with me and some of the customers thought of that I came from the Middle East. They thought, when I said I'm from India, it's like, oh, yeah, I know. I don't trust the Middle East. It's like, yeah, but I am not from the Middle East. And also people, a lot of people thought of me as a Muslim. They didn't say, but they implied a lot of times that mm-hmm. I might be Muslim. So I tried to say, look, my last name is Singh. So like, oh, so that means you're Shiite?
Oh,
like,
boy.
No.
And this is 2 years after 9/11, too, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty close to that, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think they were getting most of the information from certain kind of, you know, TV stations or channels. So that's all they heard. So, yeah, I mean, and growing up in India, I'd never thought of myself anything except an Indian guy. And the countries that I was tuned into living in India, growing up there, were England or America. I had no idea where Fallujah was, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not, like, looking at anything and what's going on in Iraq, or I heard the news and stuff, but I was not interested in personally. But people always thought here in America that I was from the Middle East and I should know everything about Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, Jordan, you know.
Oh, sure. So the war would have been starting up in Iraq about the time you got this job. And so
yeah,
they're asking all kinds of questions about Baghdad.
Baghdad, yeah. Mm-hmm. So people thought, I mean, my boss thought every time she had a question about that sort of related to Middle East, she would come to me, you know, with a big smile on my face, like, I know this guy can answer this question.
She even called you late at night once, didn't she?
Sorry?
She even called you, yeah.
She did. I mean, she called me in the night. I was like, hey, you know, it's 11 o'clock in the night, but do you know where Fallujah is?
Wow.
I said, no, I don't. But it sounds like it could be in the Middle East. Like, yeah, I knew you would know.
You managed to put it somewhere in the middle of about eight countries, and that was good enough, yeah.
Right, right. So, and things like that. But I had a great time too. I mean, it was a whole experience of me becoming somebody else, my learning about my own self, re-examining my own life in a different light, and how I changed. You know, I don't know if you want to hear all this, but
yes, I do.
I'll let you ask the next question.
Okay, the next question then would be about the kinds of things you were learning about yourself by learning about other people, because it sounds like from where you came from socioeconomically in India, you probably hung around people in that group of people. And I wonder if this was a bit of an exposure for you to people who, the likes of whom you'd never known before, I mean, even in India.
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, I did have a lot of friends and family, people who came from richer backgrounds and higher caste and privileged background. And all of a sudden, I was working on the sales floor, sitting on the floor, vacuuming the floor, cleaning the toilet in the back room. And it didn't matter to people in Virginia that I came from a high caste Hindu family or my parents were educated. And so it gave me a lot of empathy. You know, for the first time in my life, I realized like what it could be like for the people who come and clean my house on a regular basis back in India. I mean, I never thought about that. They made very small, paltry amount of money. And to survive on that money for the whole month, it just blew my mind that how come it took me. I mean, I had to come to America to learn about the people back home and people here in the States too.
And a lot, you mentioned there was you're mentioning like how much you paid housekeepers in India, and it wasn't that you were deliberately trying to keep their wages down, but it's just that's what you paid. It's just sort of what you did.
That's what everybody pays them, but people don't pay any attention. Like, oh, yeah, that's you're not educated. You don't have a job. If you want, I mean, better life, you can go get education. But then it's hard. I mean, it's, you cannot go to a good school but just because you want to go to a good school. It's because there's a lot of, factors that you have to come from a good family. Your parents have to be educated for you to be able to go to a good school or have better things in life. So people are disadvantaged in America and in India, and their lives cannot change overnight.
Well, and in addition to observing people of different socioeconomic status, I mean, you got to observe race relations in a mixed-race southern city, and I just wonder how much of an education that provided for you.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't subjected to, I don't know, maybe I didn't know, but a lot of people, my own colleagues, where he talked about Ron, this guy, he said he thought that a lot of things that he didn't have in his life or he couldn't get to the place or some kind of occupation or job that he didn't get is because of his race. And he mentioned that quite a few times to me. And it made me think, you know, and that the other colleague, Jackie, was also in a similar position. She didn't have a undergraduate or any kind of bachelor's degree. She had a high school degree. She had a kid and she was supporting the kid and paying for the child care, for the health care, for the mortgage for the house and stuff. And I thought, this is true. It's sort of like a caste system, you know. Her mother was also some kind of a housekeeper in a hotel, and she became a salesperson. And she's constantly looking to get out of that sales retail business that we were together. But I was wondering what she get after this? Probably another retail job. You know, it's not that she's going to become the owner of the company, but probably one bad job to the next bad job, and the cycle goes on.
Yeah, and there were some observations too that came. I mean, you didn't drive in India, did you?
I drove a motorbike,
but never a car or truck. I mean,
never a car, no truck. No.
And as you point out, I mean, you could afford to. I mean, it's not that you. Well, the way things were twisted around America versus India, the idea that you can't afford not to have a car in parts of America.
Yeah, so the people who lived like 20 miles or 15 miles away to come to the store to work, they actually had to have a car. It was important for them to have to car. They had to have the car to have the job, you know. Mm-hmm. A lot of people in India would have the job if they have a good – they have the car if they have a good job. But here in America, it's like if you don't have a car, you don't have a job because you can't travel every day 10 miles back and forth. So you have to have some kind of car. Maybe it's a cheap car, but then you have to pay the insurance and the fuel, and that all has to come from the job you have. And it's like a vicious cycle, you know, it's the dog trying to catch its own tail.
Yeah, and the ways in which people have to depend on things working out schedule-wise and vehicle-wise. I mean, if somebody has car trouble, they don't make it to work on time, they get in trouble. If they're having problems with the kids and they have to take them home sick, that sort of thing, it changes everything. And it did affect a couple of your coworkers like that, didn't it?
It happened all the time there. I mean, I luckily lived only 3-4 miles, and I was actually on a bus line. So, and I didn't have any other things. I was married, but I didn't have any kids, so I could just leave an hour before I had to get there, so I was always on time. But people have kids, and they were coming from 10 miles, and if they had the car trouble or their babysitter didn't show up, they were always coming late or not showing up and getting in trouble with the manager.
Speaking of which, you got in trouble with the manager pretty quickly off. I mean, you got a 1 month warning to improve. What was the direction there? You had to do what?
Yeah, I was able to do a few things right, like always show up on time, dress neatly, and stuff. But the most important component of the job was to be able to sell, and I was not able to do that. I was hiding from the customers because I couldn't understand them, no matter what, Indian or any kind. People, when they came looking for something difficult, and I knew I would have to ask one of my colleagues to help him, and it made me embarrassed because I was not there to ask my colleagues to help me all the time. So I started avoiding the customers. I would like do stuff like dust something, go in the background, act like I'm like sorting out the box. But that only lasted for so long. And after a month, my sales were almost non-existent. So my manager told me, look, you know, if your sales number do not improve, we will have to let you go. And that was the time I realized, you know, either I learned to do this job or if I get fired from here, there's a very bleak chance that I'll get the next job.
Well, that's what I was going to ask about. What level of devotion you had to the job itself? I mean, it was not the best job in the world, not the kind of thing you wanted, not really in line with your degrees and your experience. But still, I mean, it was a job. I mean, so what level of like I really need to make good at this versus like, oh my God, I can't believe this place. Did you find yourself in?
Yeah, I took it as a challenge when she said your sales are not good and we will have to let you go. I said, like, you know, I have to give everything I've got to keep this job. And I started paying attention to my manager, Cindy, and how she spoke. She was the best salesperson. And I watched her, the way she talked to customers, how she pitched the products, and I started copying her. And it started working, and I started making sales here and there, and that gave me a lot of confidence. And then it became sort of a game within my own head. You know, I had to do better than my other colleagues. And after 2-3 months, a few of my colleagues started feeling a little bit threatened by my sales. You know, and that gave me a certain kind of thrill that they thought that I could beat them this month. You know, not that I was about to get fired a month ago, but they are wondering if I can beat them, and I just wanted to do well and I became a better salesman a few months, and I never left because other people found other jobs and kept. There was a big high. It's a high turnover job in retail. People come
sure.
and go,
mm-hmm.
But I stayed there for two years. So I liked my manager, and like I had learned all the products, and I knew all the zip codes around Charlottesville, and by the end of my tenure there, I'd become the top dog, as one of my colleagues said.
uh-huh. So you ended up with a certain fondness for the job in the electronics store.
Yeah, actually, I started liking the electronics and helping out people and making people happy when they walked in. And also, I had developed a certain kind of affinity for my colleagues and just the space and time and the mall, the whole scene, you know. And so I never left until I left for India for a year.
Mm-hmm. So did you consider any? I mean, obviously the way to move up in this, as you point out in the book, and some of the people around you were trying to get into the manager training program. Did you ever consider that?
No, I did not, because my wife had to go to India for a year soon because she was following her doctoral degree. So I knew I wanted to move back with her. So I didn't want to invest in something I couldn't keep doing. Like becoming manager was like going to a different city for training and. Then becoming a manager, you know, owning a store, and there was a lot of responsibility. And I was making decent money. I mean, although I was still making hourly, it was an hourly job, you know, mm-hmm. paid by the hour. But I was making better money than most other retail jobs, and I was content, and I didn't pursue that.
Well, and just for contrast here, I mean, when you earned your first check from the BBC, it was actually bigger than your father's paycheck in India, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a surprise because it was a big company, it was the BBC World Service, and they paid well. And my father's paycheck fell short of a few thousand rupees.
Wow. So I want to talk about Holly just a little bit because she does provide a foreword for the book. This is Holly Donahue Singh, your wife. I mean, she points out that she came from a working class background herself, and I wonder how much you guys would sit around and talk about your experiences at the electronics store and what she knew from her own background and the kinds of things to expect as you moved ahead working in America.
Yeah, the good thing about her being from a working class background that she didn't look down on me. She thought, this is okay, you know, keep doing it, keep at it, and don't quit. So she provided a lot of emotional support in the first few months, and she didn't think of me as you know, like I was wondering in India, if I'd married an Indian woman, she would have divorced me for this job. Like, you know, I was expecting you to be a computer engineer. Now you're doing this, go. So and she, although she also did not understand a lot of things, like, you know. She comes from a rural Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. where there are not very many people of color. And she coming to Virginia is a whole different world. So, and she learned a lot of things on retail through my eyes, especially through an immigrant's eyes. You know, I was seeing things very differently. Everything that happened every single day was something new for her. Mm-hmm. And she would have never thought that how I felt. I was looking at every single thing as a story every day, and I was happy, I was sad, but I was mostly curious about everything that was going around me. So she got to learn a lot about retail. And she also met some interesting customers while waiting for me.
And where do you guys live now?
We live in Maine, Brunswick, Maine. Mm-hmm. She teaches at Bowdoin College.
Okay. Well, it's quite a journey it's been, and we're really glad you shared it with us in this book, How May I Help You? An Immigrant's Journey from MBA to Minimum Wage. Deepak Singh, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange today. Best of luck, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey, for having me.
All right, take care.